"Listen," he said. "Odetta," the word was barely out of his mouth before the noose pulled savagely tight again. "You don't want to be calling me that. Next time you be calling me that be the last time you be calling anyone anything. My name's Detta Walker, and if you want to keep drawing breath into your lungs, you little piece of whitewashed shit, you better remember it." Eddie made choking, gagging noises and clawed at the noose. Big black spots of nothing began to explode in front of his eyes, like evil flowers. At last the choking band around his throat eased again. "Got that, honky?"
"Yes," he said,
but it was only a hoarse choke of sound.
"Then say it. Say my name."
"Detta."
"Say my whole name!"
Dangerous hysteria wavered in her voice, and at that moment Eddie was glad he couldn't see her.
"Detta Walker."
"Good."
The noose eased a little more.
"Now you listen to me, white bread, and you do it good if you want to live till sundown. You don't want to be trying to be cute like I seen you just trying to snake down and get that gun I took off of you while you was asleep. You don't want to, cause Detta, she got the sight. See what you gonna try before you try it, show. You don't want to try nothing cute, cause I ain't got no legs either. I have learned to do a lot of things since I lost them, and now I got both of that honky muffa's guns, and that ought to go for something. You think so?"
"Yeah," Eddie croaked. "I'm not feeling cute."
"Well, good. That's real good,"
she cackled.
"I've been one busy bitch while you've been sleeping. Got this business all figured out. Here's what I want you to do, white bread. Put your hands behind you and feel around till you find a loop just like the one I got round your neck. There'll be three of them. I've been braiding while you've been sleeping, lazy bones." She cackled again. "When you feel that loop, you're going to put your wrists right one against the other and slip them through it. Then you're going to feel my hand pulling that running knot tight. And when you feel that, you're going to say, 'This my chance to turn it around on this here nigger bitch, right here while she ain't got her good hold on that jerk rope.' But—"
Here Detta's voice became muffled as well as a southern darky caricature.
"You better take a look around before you go doing anything rash."
Eddie did. Detta looked more witch-like than ever, a dirty, matted thing that would have struck fear into hearts much stouter than his own. The dress she had been wearing in Macy's when the gunslinger snatched her was now filthy and torn. She'd used the knife she had taken from the gunslinger's purse, the one he and Roland had used to cut the masking tape away, to slash her dress in two other places, creating makeshift holsters just above the swell of her hips. The worn butts of the gunslinger's revolvers protruded from them. Her voice was muffled because the end of the rope was clenched in her teeth. A freshly cut end protruded from one side of her grin. The rest of the line, the part which led to the noose around his neck, protruded from the other side. There was something so predatory and barbaric about this image, the rope caught in the grin, that he was frozen, staring at her with a horror that only made her grin widen.
"You try to be cute. I'll be taking care of your hands,"
she said in her muffled voice.
"I gonna jerk your windpipe shut with my teeth, gray meat, and that time I not be letting up again, you understand?"
He didn't trust himself to speak. He only nodded.
"Good. Maybe you be living a little bit longer after all."
"If I don't," Eddie croaked, "you're never gonna have the pleasure of shoplifting in Macy's again, Detta. Because he'll know, and then it'll be everybody out of the pool."
"Hush up,"
Detta said, almost crooned.
"You just hush up. Leave the thinking to the folks that can do it. All you got to do is be feeling around for that next loop."
6. "I've been braiding while you've been sleeping," she had said, and with disgust and mounting alarm, Eddie discovered she meant exactly what she said. The rope had become a series of three running slipknots. The first she had noosed around his neck as he slept, the second secured his hands behind his back. Then she pushed him roughly over on his side and told him to bring his feet up until his heels touched his butt. He saw where this was leading and balked. She pulled one of Roland's revolvers from the slit in her dress, cocked it, and pressed the muzzle against Eddie's temple.
"You do it or I do it, gray meat," she said in that crooning voice. "Only if I do it, you gonna be dead when I do. I just kick some sand over the brains that squirt out the other side of your head, cover the hole with your hair. He think you be sleeping."
She cackled again. Eddie brought his feet up, and she quickly secured the third running slipknot around his ankles.
"There! Trussed up just as neat as a calf at a rodeo."
That described it as well as anything, Eddie thought. If he tried to bring his feet down from a position which was already growing uncomfortable, he would tighten the slipknot holding his ankles even more. That would tighten the length of rope between his ankles and his wrists, which would in turn tighten that slipknot, and the rope between his wrists and the noose she'd put around his neck, and she was dragging him, somehow dragging him, down the beach. "Hey! What?" He tried to pull back and felt everything tighten, including his ability to draw breath. He let himself go as limp as possible, and keep those feet up, don't forget that, asshole, because if you lower your feet enough, you're going to strangle, and let her drag him along the rough ground. A jag of rock peeled skin away from his cheek, and he felt warm blood begin to flow. She was panting harshly. The sound of the waves and the boom of surf ramming into the rock tunnel were louder. "Drown me? Sweet Christ, is that what she means to do?" No, of course not. He thought he knew what she meant to do, even before his face plowed through the twisted kelp which marked the high tide line, dead, salt-stinking stuff as cold as the fingers of drowned sailors. He remembered Henry saying once, sometimes they'd shoot one of our guys, an American, I mean. They knew an Arvin was no good, because wasn't any of us a go after a gook in the bush, not unless he was some fresh fish just over from the States. They'd gut-hole him, leave him screaming, then pick off the guys that tried to save him. They keep doing that until the guy died. You know what they called a guy like that, Eddie? Eddie had shaken his head, cold with the vision of it. They called him a honeypot, Henry had said. Something sweet, something to draw flies, or maybe even a bear. That's what Detta was doing, using him as a honeypot. She left him some 7 feet below the high tide line, left him without a word, left him facing the ocean. It was not the tide coming in to drown him that the gunslinger, looking through the door, was supposed to see, because the tide was on the ebb and wouldn't get up this far again for another 6 hours. And long before then, Eddie rolled his eyes up a little and saw the sun striking a long gold track across the ocean. What was it, 4 o'clock? About that. Sunset would come around 7. It would be dark long before he had to worry about the tide. And when dark came, the lobstrosities would come rolling out of the waves. They would crawl their questioning way up the beach to where he lay, helplessly trussed. And then they would tear him apart. 7. That time stretched out interminably for Eddie Dean. The idea of time itself became a joke. Even his horror of what was going to happen to him when it got dark faded as his legs began to throb with a discomfort which worked its way up the scale of feeling to pain and finally to shrieking agony. He would relax his muscles, all the knots would pull tight, and when he was on the verge of strangling, he would manage somehow to pull his ankles up again, releasing the pressure, allowing some breath to return. He was no longer sure he could make it to dark. There might come a time when he would simply be unable to bring his legs back up. Chapter 3. Roland Takes His Medicine. 1. Now Jack Mort knew the gunslinger was here. If he had been another person, an Eddie Dean or an Odetta Walker, for instance, Roland would have held palaver with the man, if only to ease his natural panic and confusion at suddenly finding oneself shoved rudely into the passenger seat of the body one's brain had driven one's whole life. But because Mort was a monster, worse than Detta Walker ever had been or could be, he made no effort to explain or speak at all. He could hear the man's clamorings, "Who are you? What's happening to me?" but disregarded them. The gunslinger concentrated on his short list of necessities, using the man's mind with no compunction at all. The clamorings became screams of terror. The gunslinger went right on disregarding them. The only way he could remain in the worm pit which was this man's mind was to regard him as no more than a combination atlas and encyclopedia. Mort had all the information Roland needed. The plan he made was rough, but rough was often better than smooth. When it came to planning, there were no creatures in the universe more different than Roland and Jack Mort. When you planned rough, you allowed room for improvisation. And improvisation, at short notice, had always been one of Roland's strong points. 2. A fat man with lenses over his eyes, like the bald man who had poked his head into Mort's office 5 minutes earlier. It seemed that in Eddie's world many people wore these, which his Mortsopedia identified as glasses, got into the elevator with him. He looked at the briefcase in the hand of the man who he believed to be Jack Mort, and then at Mort himself.
"Going to see Dorfman, Jack?"
The gunslinger said nothing.
"If you think you can talk him out of subleasing, I can tell you it's a waste of time,"
the fat man said, then blinked as his colleague took a quick step backward. The doors of the little box closed, and suddenly they were falling. He clawed at Mort's mind, ignoring the screams, and found this was all right. The fall was controlled.
"If I spoke out of turn, I'm sorry," the fat man said.
The gunslinger thought this one is afraid, too.
"You've handled the jerk better than anyone else in the firm. That's what I think."
The gunslinger said nothing. He waited only to be out of this falling coffin.
"I say so, too,"
the fat man continued eagerly.
"Why, just yesterday I was at lunch with—"
Jack Mort's head turned, and behind Jack Mort's gold-rimmed glasses, eyes that seemed a somehow different shade of blue than Jack's eyes had ever been before, stared at the fat man. "Shut up," the gunslinger said tonelessly. Color fell from the fat man's face, and he took two quick steps backward. His flabby buttocks smacked the fake wood panels at the back of the little moving coffin, which suddenly stopped. The doors opened, and the gunslinger, wearing Jack Mort's body like a tight-fitting set of clothes, stepped out with no look back. The fat man held his finger on the door-open button of the elevator and waited inside until Mort was out of sight.
"Always did have a screw loose," the fat man thought. "But this could be serious. This could be a breakdown."
The fat man found that the idea of Jack Mort tucked safely away in a sanitarium somewhere was very comforting. The gunslinger wouldn't have been surprised. 3. Somewhere between the echoing room which his Mortsopedia identified as a lobby, to wit, a place of entry and exit from the offices which filled this sky tower, and the bright sunshine of street, his Mortsopedia identified this street as both Sixth Avenue and Avenue of the Americas, the screaming of Roland's host stopped. Mort had not died of fright. The gunslinger felt, with a deep instinct which was the same as knowing, that if Mort died, their cause would be expelled forever into that void of possibility which lay beyond all physical worlds. Not dead, fainted. Fainted at the overload of terror and strangeness, as Roland himself had done upon entering the man's mind and discovering its secrets and the crossing of destinies too great to be coincidence. He was glad Mort had fainted. As long as the man's unconsciousness hadn't affected Roland's access to the man's knowledge and memories, and it hadn't, he was glad to have him out of the way. The yellow cars were public conveyances called taxis, or cabs, or hacks. The tribes which drove them, the Mortsopedia told him, were two, Spics and Mockies. To make one stop, you held your hand up like a pupil in a classroom. Roland did this, and after several taxis which were obviously empty save for their drivers had gone by him, he saw that these had signs which read off-duty. Since these were great letters, the gunslinger didn't need Mort's help. He waited, then put his hand up again. This time the taxi pulled over. The gunslinger got into the back seat. He smelled old smoke, old sweat, old perfume. It smelled like a coach in his own world.
"Where to, my friend?"
the driver asked. Roland had no idea if he was of the Spics or Mockies tribe, and had no intention of asking. It might be impolite in this world. "I'm not sure," Roland said.
"This ain't no encounter group, my friend. Time is money."
"Tell him to put his flag down," the Mortsopedia told him. "Put your flag down," Roland said.
"That ain't rolling nothing but time," the driver replied.
"Tell him you'll tip him $5, the Mortsopedia advised.
"I'll tip you $5, Roland said.
"Let's see it," the cabbie replied. "Money talks, bullshit walks."
"Ask him if he wants the money or if he wants to go fuck himself," the Mortsopedia advised instantly.
"Do you want the money or do you want to go fuck yourself?" Roland asked in a cold, dead voice.
The cabbie's eyes glanced apprehensively into the rearview mirror for just a moment, and he said no more. Roland consulted Jack Mort's accumulated store of knowledge more fully this time. The cabbie glanced up again quickly during the 15 seconds his fare spent simply sitting there with his head slightly lowered and his left hand spread across his brow as if he had an Excedrin headache. The cabbie had decided to tell the guy to get out or he'd yell for a cop when the fare looked up and said mildly, "I'd like you to take me to 7th Avenue and 49th Street. For this trip, I will pay you $10 over the fare on your taxi meter, no matter what your tribe." "A weirdo," the driver, a wasp from Vermont trying to break into showbiz, thought. "But maybe a rich weirdo." He dropped the cab into gear. "We're there, buddy," he said. And pulling into traffic, he added mentally, "And the sooner the better." 4. Improvise. That was the word. The gunslinger saw the blue and white parked down the block when he got out and read police as posse without checking Mort's store of knowledge. 2 gunslingers inside, drinking something, coffee maybe, from white paper glasses. Gunslingers, yes, but they looked fat and lax. He reached into Jack Mort's wallet, except it was much too small to be a real wallet. A real wallet was almost as big as a purse and could carry all of a man's things if he wasn't traveling too heavy, and gave the driver a bill with the number 20 on it. The cabbie drove away fast. It was easily the biggest tip he'd make that day, but the guy was so freaky he felt he had earned every cent of it. The gunslinger looked at the sign over the shop. "Clements Guns and Sporting Goods," it said. "Ammo, fishing, tackle, official facsimiles." He didn't understand all of the words, but one look in the window was all it took for him to see Mort had brought him to the right place. There were wristbands on display, badges of rank, and guns. Rifles, mostly, but pistols as well. They were chained, but that didn't matter. He would know what he needed when, if, he saw it. Roland consulted Jack Mort's mind, a mind exactly sly enough to suit his purposes, for more than a minute. 5. One of the cops in the blue and white elbowed the other. "Now that," he said, "is a serious comparison shopper." His partner laughed. "Oh, God," he said in an effeminate voice, as the man in the business suit and gold-rimmed glasses finished his study of the merchandise on display and went inside. "I think he just decided on the lavender handcuffs." The first cop choked on a mouthful of lukewarm coffee and sprayed it back into the styrofoam cup in a gust of laughter. 6. A clerk came over almost at once and asked if he could be of help. "I wonder," the man in the conservative blue suit replied, "if you have a paper..." He paused, appeared to think deeply, and then looked up. "A chart, I mean, which shows pictures of revolver ammunition." "You mean a caliber chart?" the clerk asked. The customer paused, then said, "Yes. My brother has a revolver. I have fired it, but it's been a good many years. I think I will know the bullets if I see them." "Well, you may think so," a clerk replied, "but it can be hard to tell. Was it a 22, a 38? Or maybe if you have a chart, I'll know," Roland said. "Just a sec." The clerk looked at the man in the blue suit doubtfully for a moment, then shrugged. Fuck, the customer was always right, even when he was wrong. If he had the dough to pay, that was. Money talked, bullshit walked. "I got a shooter's Bible. Maybe that's what you ought to look at." "Yes," he smiled. "Shooter's Bible. It was a noble name for a book." The man rummaged under the counter and brought out a well-thumbed volume as thick as any book the gunslinger had ever seen in his life. And yet this man seemed to handle it as if it were no more valuable than a handful of stones. He opened it on the counter and turned it around. "Take a look. Although if it's been years, you're shooting in the dark." He looked surprised, then smiled. "Pardon my pun." Roland didn't hear. He was bent over the book, studying pictures which seemed almost as real as the things they represented, marvelous pictures the Mortsopedia identified as photographs. He turned the pages slowly. No, no, no. He had almost lost hope when he saw it. He looked up at the clerk with such blazing excitement that the clerk felt a little afraid. "There," he said. "There, right there." The photograph he was tapping was one of a Winchester 45 pistol shell. It was not exactly the same as his own shells, because it hadn't been hand-thrown or hand-loaded, but he could see without even consulting the figures, which would have meant almost nothing to him anyway, that it would chamber and fire from his guns. "Well, all right, I guess you found it," the clerk said. "But don't cream your jeans, fella. I mean, they're just bullets."
"You have them?"
"Sure. How many boxes do you want?"
"How many in a box?"
50. The clerk began to look at the gunslinger with real suspicion. If the guy was planning to buy shells, he must know he'd have to show a permit to carry photo ID. No PC, no ammo, not for handguns. It was the law in the borough of Manhattan. And if this dude had a handgun permit, how come he didn't know how many shells came in a standard box of ammo?
50.
Now the guy was staring at him with slack-jawed surprise. He was off the wall, all right. The clerk edged a bit to his left, a bit nearer the cash register, and not so coincidentally a bit nearer to his own gun, a .357 mag, which he kept fully loaded in a spring clip under the counter.
50, the gunslinger repeated. He had expected 5, 10, perhaps as many as a dozen, but this... "How much money do you have?" he asked the Mortsopedia.
The Mortsopedia didn't know, not exactly, but thought there was at least $60 in his wallet.
"And how much does a box cost?"
It would be more than $60, he supposed, but the man might be persuaded to sell him part of a box. "Or $17.50, the clerk said. But Mr. Jack Mort was an accountant, and this time there was no waiting. Translation and answer came simultaneously.
3, the gunslinger said. 3 boxes.
He tapped the photograph of the shells with one finger.
150 rounds! Ye gods! What a mad storehouse of riches this world was!
The clerk wasn't moving.
"You don't have that many," the gunslinger said. He felt no real surprise. It had been too good to be true. A dream.
"Oh, I got Winchester 45s. I got 45s up the kazoo." The clerk took another step to the left, a step closer to the cash register and the gun. If the guy was a nut, something the clerk expected to find out for sure any second now, he was soon going to be a nut with an extremely large hole in his midsection.
"I got 45 ammo up the old yin-yang. What I want to know, mister, is if you got the card."
"Card?"
"A handgun permit with a photo. I can't sell you handgun ammo unless you can show me one. If you want to buy ammo without a PC, you're going to have to go up to Westchester."
The gunslinger stared at the man blankly. This was all gabble to him. He understood none of it. His Mortsopedia had some vague notion of what the man meant, but Mort's ideas were too vague to be trusted in this case. Mort had never owned a gun in his life. He did his nasty work in other ways. The man sidled another step to the left without taking his eyes from his customer's face, and the gunslinger thought, "He's got a gun. He expects me to make trouble, or maybe he wants me to make trouble, wants an excuse to shoot me." Improvise. He remembered the gunslinger sitting in their blue and white carriage down the street. Gunslingers, yes, peacekeepers, men charged with keeping the world from moving on. But these had looked, at least on a passing glance, to be nearly as soft and unobservant as everyone else in this world of lotus-eaters. Just 2 men in uniforms and caps slouched down in the seats of their carriage drinking coffee. He might have misjudged. He hoped for all their sakes that he had not.
"Oh, I understand," the gunslinger said, and drew an apologetic smile on Jack Mort's face. "I'm sorry. I guess I haven't kept track of how much the world has moved on, changed since I last owned a gun."
"No harm done," the clerk said, relaxing minutely. Maybe the guy was all right. Or maybe he was pulling a gag.
"I wonder if I could look at that cleaning kit." Roland pointed to a shelf behind the clerk.
"Sure." The clerk turned to get it, and when he did, the gunslinger removed the wallet from Mort's inside jacket pocket. He did this with the flickering speed of a fast draw. The clerk's back was to him for less than 4 seconds, but when he turned back to Mort, the wallet was on the floor.
"It's a beaut," the clerk said, smiling, having decided the guy was okay after all. Hell, he knew how lousy you felt when you made a horse's ass of yourself. He had done it in the Marines enough times. "And you don't need a goddamn permit to buy a cleaning kit either. Ain't freedom wonderful?"
Yes, the gunslinger said seriously, and pretended to look closely at the cleaning kit, although a single glance was enough to show him that it was a shoddy thing in a shoddy box. While he looked, he carefully pushed Mort's wallet under the counter with his foot. After a moment, he pushed it back with a passable show of regret. I'm afraid I'll have to pass. All right, the clerk said, losing interest abruptly. Since the guy wasn't crazy and was obviously a looker, not a buyer, their relationship was at an end. Bullshit walks. Anything else? His mouth asked, while his eyes told Blue Suit to get out. No, thank you. The gunslinger walked out without a look back. Mort's wallet was deep under the counter. Roland had set out his own honeypot. 7. Officers Carl Delavan and George O'Meara had finished their coffee and were about to move on when the man in the blue suit came out at Clements, which both cops believed to be a powder horn, police slang for a legal gun shop which sometimes sells guns to independent stick-up men with proven credentials and which does business sometimes in bulk to the mafia, and approached their squad car. He leaned down and looked in the passenger side window at O'Meara. O'Meara expected the guy to sound like a fruit, probably not as fruity as his routine about the lavender handcuff had suggested, but a poof all the same. Guns aside, Clements did a lively trade in handcuffs. These were illegal in Manhattan, and most of the people buying them weren't amateur Houdinis. The cops didn't like it, but when had what the cops thought on any given subject ever changed things? The buyers were homos with a little taste for S&M. But the man didn't sound like a fag at all. His voice was flat and expressionless, polite, but somehow dead. The tradesman in there took my wallet, he said. Who? O'Meara straightened up fast. They'd been itching to bust Justin Clements for a year and a half. If it could be done, maybe the two of them could finally swap these blue suits for detectives' badges. Probably just a pipe dream. This was too good to be true, but just the same. The tradesman. A brief pause. The clerk. O'Meara and Carl Delavan exchanged a glance. Black hair? Delavan asked. On the stocky side? Again, there was the briefest pause. Yes. His eyes were brown. Small scar under one of them. There was something about the guy. O'Meara couldn't put his finger on it then, but remembered later on, when there weren't so many other things to think about. The chief of which, of course, was a simple fact that the gold detective's badge didn't matter. It turned out that just holding on to the jobs they had would be a pure brassy-ass miracle. But years later, there was a brief moment of epiphany when O'Meara took his two sons to the Museum of Science in Boston. They had a machine there, a computer, that played tic-tac-toe. And unless you put your X in the middle square on your first move, the machine fucked you over every time. But there was always a pause as it checked its memory for all possible gambits. He and the boys had been fascinated, but there was something spooky about it. And then he remembered Blue Suit. He remembered because Blue Suit had had that same fucking habit. Talking to him had been like talking to a robot. Delavan had no such feeling, but 9 years later, when he took his own son, then 18 and about to start college, to the movies one night, Delavan would rise unexpectedly to his feet about 30 minutes into the feature and scream, "It's him! That's him! That's the guy in a fucking blue suit! The guy who was at Cle—" Somebody would shout down in front, but needn't have bothered. Delavan, 70 pounds overweight and a heavy smoker, would be struck by a fatal heart attack before the complainer even got to the second word. The man in the blue suit who approached their cruiser that day and told them about his stolen wallet didn't look like the star of the movie, but the dead delivery of words had been the same. So had the somehow relentless yet graceful way he moved. The movie, of course, had been the Terminator. 8. The cops exchanged a glance. The man Blue Suit was talking about wasn't Clements, but almost as good. Fat Johnny Holden, Clements' brother-in-law. But to have done something as totally dumbass as simply stealing a guy's wallet would be right up that gink's alley, O'Meara's mind finished. And he had to put a hand to his mouth to cover a momentary little grin. Maybe you better tell us exactly what happened, Delavan said. You can start with your name. Again, the man's response struck O'Meara as a little wrong, a little offbeat. In this city, where it sometimes seemed that 70% of the population believed go fuck yourself was American for have a nice day, he would have expected the guy to say something like, hey, that SOB took my wallet. Are you going to get it back for me, or are we going to stand out here playing 20 questions? But there was the nicely cut suit, the manicured fingernails. A guy may be used to dealing with bureaucratic bullshit. In truth, George O'Meara didn't care much. The thought of busting Fat Johnny Holden and using him as a lever on Arnold Clements made O'Meara's mouth water. For one fuzzy moment, he even allowed himself to imagine using Holden to get Clements and Clements to get one of the really big guys, that Wap Balazar, for instance, or maybe Ginelli. That wouldn't be too tacky, not too tacky at all. "My name is Jack Mort," the man said. Delavan had taken a butt-warped pad from his back pocket. "Address?" That slight pause. Like the machine, O'Meara thought again. A moment of silence, then an almost audible click. 409 Park Avenue South. Delavan jotted it down. Social Security number. After another slight pause, Mort recited it. "Want you to understand, I gotta ask you these questions for identification purposes. If the guy did take your wallet, it's nice if I can say you told me certain stuff before I take it into my possession. You understand?" "Yes." Now there was the slightest hint of impatience in the man's voice. It made O'Meara feel a little better about him somehow. "Just don't drag it out any more than you have to. Time passes, and things have a way of happening. Yeah, I dig." "Things have a way of happening," the man in the blue suit agreed. "Yes. Do you have a photo in your wallet that's distinctive?" A pause, then, "A picture of my mother taken in front of the Empire State Building. On the back is written, 'It was a wonderful day and a wonderful view. Love, Mom.'" Delavan jotted furiously, then snapped his notebook closed. "Okay, that should do it. Only other thing will be to have you write your signature if we get the wallet back and compare it with the SIGs on your driver's license, credit cards, stuff like that, okay?" Roland nodded. Although part of him understood that although he could draw on Jack Mort's memories and knowledge of this world as much as he needed, he hadn't a chance in hell of duplicating Mort's signature with Mort's consciousness absent, as it was now. "Tell us what happened." "I went in to buy shells for my brother. He has a .45 Winchester revolver. The man asked me if I had a permit to carry. I said, of course. He asked to see it." Pause. "I took out my wallet. I showed him. Only when I turned my wallet around to do that showing, he must have seen there were quite a few..." Slight pause. "20s in there. I am a tax accountant. I have a client named Dorfman who just won a small tax refund after an extended..." Pause. "Litigation. The sum was only $800, but this man Dorfman is..." Pause. "The biggest prick we handle." Pause. "Pardon my pun." O'Meara ran the man's last few words back through his head and suddenly got it. "The biggest prick we handle. Not bad." He laughed. Thoughts of robots and machines that played tic-tac-toe went out of his mind. The guy was real enough, just upset, and trying to hide it by being cool. Anyway, Dorfman wanted cash. He insisted on cash. "You think Fat Johnny got a look at your client's dough?" Delavan said. He and O'Meara got out of the blue and white. "Is that what you call the man in that shop?" "Oh, we call him worse than that on occasion," Delavan said. "What happened after you showed him your PC, Mr. Mort?" "He asked for a closer look. I gave him my wallet, but he didn't look at the picture. He dropped it on the floor. I asked him what he did that for. He said that was a stupid question. Then I told him to give me back my wallet. I was mad." "I'll bet you were." Although looking at the man's dead face, Delavan thought you'd never guess this man could get mad. "He laughed. I started to come around the counter and get it. That was when he pulled the gun." They had been walking toward the shop. Now they stopped. They looked excited rather than fearful. "Gun?" O'Meara asked, wanting to be sure he had heard right. "It was under the counter by the cash register," the man in the blue suit said. Roland remembered the moment when he had almost junked his original plan and gone for the man's weapon. Now he told these gunslingers why he hadn't. He wanted to use them, not get them killed. "I think it was in a Dockers clutch," A what? O'Meara asked. A longer pause this time. The man's forehead wrinkled. I don't know exactly how to say it. A thing you put your gun into. No one can grab it but you unless they know how to push... A spring clip, Delavan said. Holy shit! Another exchange of glances between the partners. Neither wanted to be the first to tell this guy that Fat Johnny had probably harvested the cash from his wallet already, shucked his buns out the back door, and tossed it over the wall of the alley behind the building. But a gun in a spring clip? That was different. Robbery was a possible, but all at once a concealed weapons charge looked like a sure thing. Maybe not as good, but a foot in the door. What then? O'Meara asked. Then he told me I didn't have a wallet. He said, pause, that I got my picket pocked. My pocket picked, I mean, on the street, and I'd better remember it if I wanted to stay healthy. I remembered seeing a police car parked up the block, and I thought you might still be there. So I left. Okay, Delavan said. Me and my partner are going in first, and fast. Give us about a minute, a full minute, just in case of some trouble. Then come in, but stand by the door. Do you understand? Yes. Okay. Let's bust this motherfucker. The two cops went in. Roland waited 30 seconds, and then followed them. 9. Fat Johnny Holden was doing more than protesting. He was bellowing.
Guy's crazy! Guy comes in here, doesn't even know what he wants. Then when he sees it in the shooter's Bible, he don't know how many comes in a box, how much they cost. And what he says about me wanting a closer look at his PC is the biggest pile of shit I ever heard, because he don't have no permit to...
Fat Johnny broke off.
There he is! There's the creep! Right there! I see you, buddy. I see your face. Next time you see mine, you're gonna be fucking sorry. I guarantee you that. I fucking guarantee you don't have this man's wallet, O'Meara asked. You know I don't have his wallet!
You mind if we take a look behind this display case, Delavan countered, just to be sure?
Jesus fucking jumped up Christ on a pony! The case is glass! You see any wallets there?
No, not there. I meant here, Delavan said, moving toward the register. His voice was a cat's purr. At this point, a chrome steel reinforcing strip, almost 2 feet wide, ran down the shelves of the case. Delavan looked back at the man in the blue suit, who nodded.
I want you guys out of here right now, Fat Johnny said.
He had lost some of his color.
You come back with a warrant, that's different. But for now, I want you to fuck out. Still a free fucking country, you know. Hey, quit that!
O'Meara was peering over the counter.
That's illegal! Fat Johnny was howling. That's fucking illegal! The Constitution! My fucking lawyer! You get back on your side right now or...
I just wanted a closer look at the merchandise, O'Meara said mildly.
On account of the glass in your display case is so fucking dirty. That's why I looked over, isn't it, Carl?
True shit, buddy, Delavan said solemnly.
And look what I found.
Roland heard a click, and suddenly the gunslinger in the blue uniform was holding an extremely large gun in his hand. Fat Johnny, who had finally realized he was the only person in the room who would tell a story that differed from the fairy tale just told by the cop who had taken his mag, turned sullen.
I got a permit, he said.
To carry? Delavan asked.
Yeah.
To carry concealed?
Yeah.
This gun registered? O'Meara asked.
It is, isn't it?
Well, I might have forgot.
Might be it's hot, and you forgot that, too.
Fuck you! I'm calling my lawyer.
Fat Johnny started to turn away. Delavan grabbed him. Then there's the question of whether or not you got a permit to conceal a deadly weapon in a spring clip device, he said, in the same soft, purring voice. That's an interesting question, because so far as I know, the city of New York doesn't issue a permit like that. The cops were looking at Fat Johnny. Fat Johnny was glaring back at them. So none of them noticed Roland turn the sign hanging in the door from open to closed.
Maybe we could start to resolve this matter if we could find the gentleman's wallet, O'Meara said.
Satan himself could not have lied with such genial persuasiveness.
Maybe he just dropped it, you know?
I told you I don't know nothing about the guy's wallet. Guy's out of his mind!
Roland bent down. There it is, he remarked. I can just see it. He's got his foot on it. This was a lie, but Delavan, whose hand was still on Fat Johnny's shoulder, shoved the man back so rapidly that it was impossible to tell if the man's foot had been there or not. It had to be now. Roland glided silently toward the counter as the two gunslingers bent to peer under the counter. Because they were standing side by side, this brought their heads close together. O'Meara still had the gun the clerk had kept under the counter in his right hand. "God damn, it's there!" Delavan said excitedly. "I see it!" Roland snapped a quick glance at the man they had called Fat Johnny, wanting to make sure he was not going to make a play. But he was only standing against the wall, pushing against it, actually, as if wishing he could push himself into it, with his hands hanging at his sides and his eyes great wounded O's. He looked like a man wondering how come his horoscope hadn't told him to beware this day. No problem there. "Yeah," O'Meara replied gleefully. The two men peered under the counter, hands on uniformed knees. Now O'Meara's left his knee, and he reached out to snag the wallet. "I see it, too." Roland took one final step forward. He cupped Delavan's right cheek in one hand, O'Meara's left cheek in the other, and all of a sudden, the day Fat Johnny Holden believed had to have hit rock bottom got a lot worse. The spook in the blue suit brought the cops' heads together hard enough to make a sound like rocks wrapped in felt colliding with each other. The cops fell in a heap. The man in the gold-rimmed specs stood. He was pointing the .357 mag at Fat Johnny. The muzzle looked big enough to hold a moon rocket. "We're not going to have any trouble, are we?" the spook asked in his dead voice. "No, sir," Fat Johnny said at once. "Not a bit." "Stand right there. If your ass loses contact with that wall, you are going to lose contact with life as you have always known it. You understand?"
"Yes, sir," Fat Johnny said. "I sure do."
"Good."